Lecture 18, The Battles of Cannae and Zama.
Having reviewed the early years of the Legion, we begin our survey of Roman-era battles with a disaster and a triumph, both of which occurred in the Second Punic War of 218 to 202 BC between Rome and Carthage. As related in my History of Ancient Rome course, the Romans had fought a titanic struggle with Carthage between 264 and 241 BC, the First Punic War. When a second war broke out in 218 BC, the Romans expected it to mimic the first and be a major naval effort. Instead, the commander of Carthaginian forces in Spain, Hannibal Barca, seized the initiative and marched an army overland to Italy, crossing the Pyrenees and the Alps in the process. It was a move of astonishing daring, but of the 59,000 men and 60 elephants that he had started out with, Hannibal staggered into northern Italy in November of 218 BC with 26,000 men and 20 elephants left. His troops looked like beggars from their privations. Despite being reinforced from the local Gallic tribesmen who had succumbed to the Roman yoke only a few years earlier, Hannibal found himself challenged almost immediately by a large Roman army of 40,000. As a December storm raged, Hannibal inflicted a crushing defeat on the Romans at the River Trebia, killing or capturing the better part of 30,000 of them. Victorious in the north, Hannibal moved south the following spring, threatening Rome itself. The consul, Gaius Flaminius, tried to block him. On a misty morning in June of 217 BC, on the shores of Lake Trasimene in Umbria, Hannibal staged an ambush. Sandwiched between the lake on one side and the attacking Carthaginians on the other, the Romans were all but annihilated. Along with 15,000 of his men, Flaminius himself lay dead on the field. That Hannibal did not lay siege to Rome after Trasimene suggests that he was not interested in physically destroying the place, or probably, more likely, that he was incapable of doing so. His intention, rather, was to humiliate the Romans in battle and thereby break up the Roman Confederation in Italy. The Romans had organized Italy into a series of treaty arrangements between themselves and the conquered peoples. It was this organization that Hannibal was attacking. If he succeeded in doing this, he would destroy Roman power for good, and with it, Rome's imperial future. The best evidence for Hannibal's strategy is his treatment of the captives. Roman citizens he treated harshly, exposed to the elements, or killed outright. Italian captives, in contrast, were well fed, hospitably housed, and then released after a speech by Hannibal in which he declared himself their liberator from Roman oppression. This happened after both Trebia and Trasimene. Yet the truth of the matter was that by the end of 217 BC, neither the Roman defeats nor Hannibal's mercy had detached a single central Italian community from their alliance with Rome. Perhaps inspired by his experiences in the north, Hannibal headed south, where recently subjugated Greek and Samnite populations offered a potentially rich pool of defectors. In the wake of the Trasimene disaster, the Romans appointed a dictator, a special emergency magistrate. This was Quintus Fabius Maximus, an experienced and cool-headed aristocrat. Rather than confronting Hannibal directly, Fabius marshaled his forces to shadow Hannibal's movements. He kept the enemy in check by attacking or capturing his foragers and stragglers and constantly threatening his security. These Fabian tactics, while very effective, were singularly unspectacular. In the face of Hannibal's unanswered depredations, Fabius's cautious approach slowly became unpopular. So the Roman people elected as consuls for 216 BC the young and aggressive Gaius Terentius Varro, along with an older and more experienced man, Lucius Aemilius Paulus. The new consuls raised a vast combined force of 8 legions and an equal number of allies and marched it south to confront Hannibal. Estimates of the size of the Roman army, ancient and modern, vary from 45,000 at the low end to 88,000 at the upper. But we can arrive at a reasonable estimate by looking closely at what the ancients tell us. 8 legions at normal strength, that would be 4,500 apiece, would be 36,000 legionaries, 2,400 of whom would be cavalry. An equal number of allied infantry adds a further 33,600, for a total of almost 70,000 infantry. Polybius says that the combined allied and Roman cavalry numbered 6,000. Thus, on these bases, the Roman army setting out against Hannibal was at least 76,000 strong. But, as we saw in the last lecture, in emergencies, legionary infantry strength could be raised to 5,000 men, and Hannibal roaming around Italy was definitely an emergency. If so, we can add a further 6,400 legionaries. A fair estimate, then, of the size of the Roman army is therefore in the region of about 83,000 men or more. Of this force, 6,000 were cavalry, about 18,000 would be skirmishers and light-armed, and the rest, almost 60,000 men, heavy infantry. This was the largest Roman army by far yet put into the field. That's how determined Rome was to crush Hannibal. We saw last time how this Roman army would have been composed and equipped. Hannibal's force was quite a different animal altogether. No Punic histories have survived extant, not even those written by outsiders. Polybius describes Hannibal's army only in vague, rhetorically charged contrasts with the Roman military institutions that he so admired. But from his account, and those from other writers, we can discern the broad shape of his army. Carthage did not usually field a citizen militia, but relied instead on mercenaries and levies from subject or allied peoples. In extreme circumstances, the Carthaginians could indeed muster the citizenry, as when, for instance, they were forced to fight their own unpaid mercenaries after losing the First Punic War in 241 BC. But even then, mercenaries were added to the militia, and the entire force numbered only 10,000. Punic armies were usually ethnically diverse, mixes of North Africans, Spaniards, and the usual hodgepodge of outcasts who hired themselves out to fight other people's wars. Ethnic units had their own native officers, but the senior command was always Carthaginian. Hannibal's multinational force had no standardized equipment, and each group fought according to its traditional methods. The people of Numidia, for instance, provided light cavalrymen armed with javelins and possibly short swords, and riding short, stumpy ponies. Numidian cavalry was quick and maneuverable, perfect for skirmishing. More obscure are the Libby-Phoenician heavy cavalry, armed in the Hellenistic fashion, with helmet, corselet, sword, lance, shield, and perhaps javelins. Balearic Islanders from Spain used the sling, a devastatingly effective weapon in the hands of a master. Libyan heavy infantry, a combination of subject levies and mercenaries, had long been a staple of Punic armies. Uncertainty surrounds their normal equipment, but at Cannae, we are told that they were armed with captured Roman equipment looted from the fallen at Trebia and Trasimene. Spanish levies and Gallic defectors from the north of Italy made up the rest of Hannibal's heavy infantry. The Spanish were formidable fighters, largely unarmored, but wielding short swords, javelins, and large oval shields. They carried the short swords that the Romans themselves had, of course, adopted. The Gladius Hispaniensis are a different type called a coppice by the Greeks, sharp on one side and curved inward and designed for slashing. They probably fought in tribal units under their own local officers, which would have lent them a great esprit de corps as they fought alongside men from their home communities. The North Italian Gauls were also unarmored, save for a helmet, usually naked, either from the waist up or wholly naked, and they carried oval shields, spears, javelins, and their characteristic long swords for slashing. Other elements in Hannibal's army included Moors and Ligurians, who fought as infantry skirmishers, and the Gaetuli, who provided light cavalry similar to those from Numidia. There was also a contingent of Spanish medium-heavy cavalry armed with sword, javelin or spear, shield but no body armor, and Celtic cavalry as well. These latter would have been the cream of Gallic society, well equipped with mail shirts, helmets, round shields, long swords and a lance. So Hannibal's army was quite the contrast with the culturally homogenous and, relatively speaking, uniformly equipped Romans. There was a distinct advantage inherent in Hannibal's apparently unwieldy tool, though. He had at his disposal a rich selection of materials to tailor to his tactical needs. The army was also well motivated and brilliantly led, utterly devoted to its gifted general after serving under him in Spain for many years. And here it was now, engaged in a great foreign adventure, with two victories already under its belt. The Carthaginians at Cannae have sometimes been compared to the army of Alexander at Gaugamela. Events were to prove the comparison justified. As to its size, Hannibal's force was around 50,000 strong, broken down as follows: 8,000 infantry skirmishers and slingers, in cavalry 2,000 Spanish, 4,000 Gauls, 4,000 Numidians, and a few hundred Libby-Phoenician heavy horsemen, in infantry 8,000 to 10,000 Libyans, 6,000 Spanish, and 16,000 Gauls. This was the army that awaited the Romans at Cannae in southern Italy. The vast consular horde arrived and set up camp about 5 miles distant from the Carthaginians. The sources present Varro as an aggressive hothead spoiling for a fight, and Paulus as the more calculating partner. In fact, both consuls were keen to fight, but they disagreed over the best place to do it. In accordance with the Roman tradition, command alternated between the two consuls on a daily basis. After some skirmishing by the Romans under Varro, the Romans deployed in the plain between the camps for battle. It was the 2nd of August 216 BC, a hot and dry summer's day. The Romans left 10,000 men to guard their camp, the Carthaginians maybe 8,000. If so, Varro and Paulus had some 73,000 men deployed for battle, facing Hannibal's 42,000. In contrast to Hannibal's experienced veterans, the Roman army was mostly raw recruits, but its enormous size instilled confidence in the men. The Roman army formed up in its normal configuration, with the legions in the middle, allies on the wings, and cavalry on the flanks. But on this occasion, the maniples were stationed closer together than normal, and also greater depth was given to their formation, effectively transforming them into small columns. These adjustments may have been forced on the consuls by the size of the army, or it may have been part of a plan to punch through Hannibal's line. Whatever the case, they deprived the legions of their customary flexibility, and, unfortunately for the Romans, played directly into Hannibal's hands. Hannibal's deployment at Cannae is one of the most celebrated in all of military history and bears the mark of genius. On the surface, it appeared unexceptional. Skirmishers out front, infantry in the middle, and cavalry on the wings. But the vision was in the details. His heavier cavalry, some 6,000 strong, Hannibal put on the left wing, facing the 2,400 legionary cavalry, while the 4,000 lightly armed Numidians faced an almost equal force of 3,600 Italian cavalry on the right. The Punic infantry deployment, however, was especially cunning. Hannibal stationed his strongest troops, the Libyans, on the wings, divided into two units of about 4,000 to 5,000 each, and deployed in column. The column disguised their strength. When viewed from the front, their numbers were concealed in their depth. The weaker Celts and Spanish occupied the center. Taking personal command here, Hannibal led the Celts and Spanish forward without breaking their line, so that their line bowed outward toward the Romans. Polybius is quite explicit that this shallow crescent formation was not accidental, as some have argued, but was a deliberate ploy on Hannibal's part. Its purpose is best appreciated by examining the course of the battle itself. After an opening clash of skirmishers, the cavalry wings engaged. The Numidians held the allies on the Punic right, but the Carthaginian heavy cavalry, which outnumbered the Romans by about 3-1, easily drove them off on the left. Meanwhile, the Roman infantry advanced. Owing to the strange crescent shape of the Punic centre, the front of engagement was initially very narrow, so that the Roman maniples on either side began to move toward the crescent's apex to participate in the anticipated victory. Under immense pressure, the Spanish and Gauls yielded, but they did not break, so gradually the convex bow of their formation became a concave bowl. All this time, the Libyans waited in column on the wings. The Romans, driving hard at the central point, were channeled away from the Libyans toward the center, which now broke and drew the Romans in further still. At this point, the Libyans turned to face inward and charged both Roman flanks. The function of Hannibal's crescent ought now to be clear. It served to lure the Romans to attack his center while leaving the disguised Libyan wings, the jaws of his vice, unmolested until they could assail the Roman flanks. Cannae was, in effect, an ambush sprung in the open. On the Punic right, the Numidians had been holding their own against the allied Italian cavalry. The Italians, wishing to get to blows, could not nail down these elusive nomadic warriors on their fast little horses. But when the Punic heavy cavalry had driven off the Romans on the left, they showed up to the rear of the Italians and put them to flight. As the Numidians pursued the Italians, the Punic heavy cavalry was freed to seal the fate of the beleaguered legions. The 6,000 heavy horse charged the legions' rear, probably augmented by the Punic skirmishers. Hannibal had achieved what very few generals ever have, the complete encirclement of his enemy. And even more amazingly, he had done it with an outnumbered army. In military terms, Cannae was a triumph. In human terms, it was a tragedy. The Roman maniples began to lose their cohesion when they started pushing toward the centre relatively early in the battle. By the end, they were a panicked rabble, herded into a narrow space and attacked from all sides. This total degeneration also explains why they did not break through Hannibal's centre and cause major problems there. Cohesive action was no longer possible for them. Libya says that only 370 Roman and allied Italian cavalry escaped death or capture, while only 3,000 infantrymen survived. This was set Roman losses at Cannae in the neighbourhood of 70,000. In contrast, he says, Hannibal lost a little under 6,000, three quarters of them from his heavily engaged centre. Livy puts Hannibal's losses at about 8,000. Both figures, 6 or 8,000, are still quite significant for an invading army isolated on the enemy's soil. The total Roman dead, Livy numbers at 48,300. Elsewhere, he rounds that off to 50,000, of which he says 2,700 were cavalry, far lower than Polybius' figures in both counts. But even these lowball totals have nearly 50,000 Romans killed or captured at Cannae. To many, this seems an extremely unlikely figure. With muskets and artillery, Napoleon could only inflict 44,000 casualties in his bloodiest battle, Borodino, fought against the Russians on the 7th of September 1812. The bloodiest day of the American Civil War was the 17th of September 1862 at Antietam, which saw a total of 23,500 casualties killed and injured for both sides. Even the machine guns and howitzers of the German Imperial Army took a toll of 58,000 casualties all told from the British Army at the Somme on the 1st of July 1916. So it's reasonable to ask how men wielding edged weapons could hope to emulate the carnage of industrialized warfare. Surely the butcher's bill from Cannae has been vastly inflated. It is salutary to recall here that men armed mostly with machetes and sharpened gardening tools managed to outpace the Nazi death camps in rate of killing during the 100-day Rwandan genocide in 1994. When one's victims are helpless and prostrate, are, as at Cannae, compressed and panicked, it is possible to do a lot of damage with sharp, handheld weapons. If most of the Roman losses occurred when the army was surrounded, then all of Hannibal's infantry and his heavy cavalry units would have participated in the massacre. Since the 4,000 losses incurred by Hannibal's centre likely accumulated in the opening phases, we can exclude them for the sake of argument. This still leaves about 34,000 Punic troops engaged in the work of slaughter. To inflict 45,500 Roman infantry losses enumerated by Livy, and his figures are more reasonable, I think, than are those of Polybius, each Carthaginian would have to have killed or disabled, on average, only 1 1/3 opponents. If the battle lasted about 9 hours, as one scholar estimates, that represents about 84 Roman casualties per minute. If this still seems unrealistic, recall that these casualties occurred not in sequence, but concurrently, and that many tens of thousands of combatants were engaged on four fronts. It is true that the capacity of the human body to wield edged weapons is limited, so that there may have been natural lulls in the fighting as men became exhausted and drew apart for a break. If so, the killing came in waves. But the physical realities of ancient combat and the relative closeness of the enemy meant that, even during supposed lulls, there were few options other than to fight, if for no other reason than to save one's skin. So the casualty figures, despite their enormity, are not as inherently unlikely as the modern comparanda might suggest. Among the fallen were 80 prominent citizens, including the consul Paulus, both consuls of the previous year, and numerous ex-magistrates. Varro, blamed in the sources as the culprit for the catastrophe, escaped on horseback. For soldiers, battle is an intensely localized experience. Most have no perception of the big picture of what units are doing elsewhere or how the larger movements may affect their fates. This uncertainty, in fact, is one of the terrors of combat. At Cannae, Hannibal's tactical movements succeeded in completely encircling the Romans. This fact would only gradually have impinged on the legionary's immediate experience of the engagement, as the clamour of battle closed in on all sides. Rumours would have run through the ranks, bringing confusion in their wake. If, as some reports have it, wind blew dust into the Romans' faces, then the confusion would have been intensified, only to be replaced by terror as their predicament dawned on them. The will to fight would have evaporated, the survival instinct kicked in, and desperation would have destroyed unit cohesion, and with it, their last hope for survival. At the end, the sources tell us, they were packed so tight they couldn't even draw their swords. It must have been indescribably horrible. The next day, the victors returned to strip the spoils. Any wounded Romans were dispatched with the coup de grace, some begging to be killed, so horrible were their injuries. Romans were found who had buried their heads in the earth and suffocated themselves. This probably shows that mines snapped in the face of the intense horror. Livy offers an especially brutal vignette illustrating the savagery of the combat. A Numidian was found, still alive, with the corpse of a Roman on top of him. The Numidian's nose and ears were horribly lacerated, since the Roman, in his death throes, had torn at them with his teeth. Despite its tactical decisiveness, Cannae decided nothing. Parts of South Italy defected to Hannibal, and Philip V of Macedon rushed to make a pact with him, but the core Italian alliance stood by Rome. Having cost them about 100,000 losses since his invasion of Italy began less than 2 years earlier, Hannibal might reasonably have expected envoys to arrive seeking peace, but they didn't. No truces were proposed, no negotiated settlement proffered. Even Hannibal's offer to ransom his Roman prisoners was rebuffed. The defeated consul Varro finally arrived in Rome to face the music, but he was not punished. Instead, the Senate thanked him for not despairing of the Republic. The war was to continue, it seems. The shock of Cannae rehabilitated the Fabian tactics, and Hannibal was never again challenged in a major battle on Italian soil. In this sense, the sheer scale of his tactical victory at Cannae proved his strategic undoing. But that Hannibal held together an ethnically diverse mercenary army on the territory of the enemy for 13 further years without it melting away beneath him speaks volumes about his leadership and how his troops felt about him. With Hannibal checked in Italy, the Romans concentrated on destroying his support bases in Punic-held Spain and fending off threats in Sardinia, Sicily, and in Illyria across the Adriatic. This global strategic approach proved very successful. The last attempt to reinforce Hannibal in Italy foundered at the Battle of the Metaurus in 207 BC, and the following year, the Punic forces were washed out of Spain for good. The spectacular successes in Spain were the work of Publius Cornelius Scipio, in whose person Rome had found a leader equal to the great Carthaginian himself. Scipio hailed from a family that had provided Rome with a long line of prominent citizens since the 4th century BC. Little is known of his early life, but as a 19-year-old military tribune, he had been present at Cannae. Scipio's father and uncle had been active in Spain against the Punic forces there, but in 211 BC, they were both killed, their forces destroyed, and the whole Roman effort in Spain jeopardized. Against prevailing custom, the young Scipio was appointed proconsul in Spain in 210 BC, despite having held no higher office prior to this, which was usually a requirement of those put in charge of Roman armies. Between 210 and 206 BC, he showed a boldness and ability that turned the tide of the war. His very first move, for instance, was to attack and capture the Punic headquarters in Spain at New Carthage, modern-day Cartagena. Scipio continued in this vein, energetic and aggressive, until his great victories at Baecula in 208 and at Ilippa 2 years later cleared Punic forces out of the Iberian Peninsula for good. In both of these battles, by the way, Scipio revealed a taste for flanking maneuvers, apparently inspired by Hannibal's own tactics at Cannae. Scipio's glittering successes had by now made him a hero at home. He was elected unanimously to the consulate of 205, despite being legally underage for such high office. His characteristically bold plan was to take the war to Africa, even as Hannibal was still in Italy. Despite stiff resistance in some quarters, notably from Fabius Maximus, cautious to a T, Scipio finally led an army over to Africa in the summer of 204 BC. There, he enlisted support from the exiled Numidian king Massinissa, and with him an invaluable contingent of Numidian cavalry. Massinissa had previously fought with the Carthaginians in Spain, but now, driven from his kingdom by dynastic disputes, he threw in his lot with the Roman invader. When Scipio defeated the Carthaginians at the Battle of the Great Plains in Africa in 203 BC, Hannibal was recalled from Italy to confront him. Scipio and Hannibal finally faced each other across the field at Zama, southwest of Carthage in 202, probably sometime in October. Riding out from their respective camps, the two generals met, accompanied only by interpreters. While our surviving accounts of their exchange are probably works of the imagination, Polybius's connections to the Scipionic family may preserve at least that family's tradition of what was said. Hannibal, reports Polybius, mused on the themes of empire and luck in war. He declared himself open to suggestions as to how a battle might be avoided, and then he proffered terms. Scipio commented that the gods thus far had favored the Romans since they were not the aggressors in the wider war. He assured Hannibal that he was well aware of how quickly fortune could change in war, but he rejected Hannibal's terms and demanded unconditional surrender. Livy, by the way, has much the same content, only couched in greater verbiage. The two men then parted and prepared to fight. The next day, the Battle of Zama took place. Hannibal marshaled perhaps 40 or 50,000 troops in all, including 4,000 cavalry and over 80 war elephants. Scipio had about 30,000 men, including 4,000 to 6,000 Numidian cavalry. Scipio adjusted his deployment to deal with the elephants. The maniples of the front two lines were aligned one behind the other, and then the light-armed velites stationed in these contiguous gaps. The Numidians he put on his right wing, the Italian cavalry on his left. Hannibal also drew up his army in three lines. Behind the elephants at the very front, he stationed 12,000 mercenaries. Then he had a line of Libyans, presumably levied locally to meet the Roman threat, and then finally his veterans from Italy in the third line. What is interesting here is that Hannibal's third line, his veterans, was held about 200 yards back from the rest. In other words, Hannibal was holding his best troops in reserve. On the wings, he stationed the cavalry, Numidians on the left to confront their compatriots across the field, and the others on the right facing the Italians. The clash opened with skirmishing between the Numidian cavalry on both sides. Hannibal ordered his elephants forward with disastrous results. The animals became startled by trumpet blasts and a concerted war cry from the Roman lines and stampeded, turning back onto Hannibal's own troops. Some, in fact, did reach the Roman lines, but they passed harmlessly through the contiguous gaps between the maniples. The Punic cavalry on the right was driven off by the rampaging elephants and are a charge by the Romans opposite. The front lines of infantry then engaged. The mercenaries at first did well, but gradually the Hastati gained the upper hand. Polybius offers a psychological explanation for this. The Libyans and Carthaginians held back and gave their frontline mercenaries the impression that they had been abandoned, while the second and third Roman lines stayed close behind the Hastati and cheered them on. The mercenaries lost the all-important will to fight, broke, and began actually attacking Hannibal's second line, which had been ordered not to admit them. Caught between the Romans and their own employer, the mercenaries either perished or fled the field as best they could. The Romans are, if we believe Polybius, only the Hastati, then engaged the second line and prevailed again. The detritus of battle forced Scipio to redeploy his army before facing the still distant third Punic line. Hannibal did nothing to interfere as Scipio drew up his Principes and Triarii alongside the remnants of the Hastati to form a single continuous line. Having denied himself the means of effecting line relief, Scipio put all his hopes on this final clash. The Romans advanced and, in a hard fight, got the better of it when the victorious Italian and Numidian cavalry returned and charged the Carthaginians in the rear. Hannibal fled, leaving 20,000 of his men dead and the same number captured. Scipio lost 1,500. The Battle of Zama was won by the fighting qualities of the Roman legionary rather than by any tactical sophistication. The flexibility of the manipular formation was proven twice, at the outset with the throughways set up to try to neutralize the elephant charge, and before the final clash when the maniples reformed into a single line. But the staying power of the legionaries won the day. As Polybius says of them, and remember again, he saw them in action, the arms they carry both give protection and instill great confidence into them because of the size of the shields and the strength of the swords, which can withstand repeated blows. All of these factors make the Romans formidable antagonists in battle and very hard to overcome. Unlike Cannae, Zama was decisive on both the tactical and the strategic planes. Carthage was defeated and forced to accept humiliating terms. The city could never again mount a serious challenge to Roman hegemony in the Western Mediterranean. Indeed, Zama heralded Rome's supremacy in the wider Mediterranean world. Rome now had overseas commitments in Spain and southern France, in addition to its existing holdings in Sicily, Sardinia, and Corsica. Philip V of Macedon's rash pact with Hannibal after Cannae also gave the Romans a reason to look eastward. And with the West secured, the Romans were increasingly looking eastward. After Zama, Hannibal enjoyed a brief but unfortunately unsuccessful career as a domestic politician. But he was forced into exile by political rivals and pursued with absolute vindictiveness by Roman envoys demanding his surrender. He eventually committed suicide in Turkey in 183 or 182 BC. Scipio was dubbed Africanus, meaning Scipio of Africa, as a result of Zama. The first time a Roman general had been named for the site of his victory in this way. He remained eminent among his peers, but eminence at Rome invited envy. His final years were marred by charges of corruption, and he died complaining about his compatriots' ingratitude in 184 BC, only a year or two before his great rival. There is a story that Hannibal and Scipio met again almost 10 years after Zama in Ephesus, when Scipio was on an embassy to King Antiochus of Syria. The old adversaries discussed generalship, and Scipio asked Hannibal whom he regarded was the greatest general of all. Alexander was the response. And who was second? Pyrrhus. And third, and without hesitation, Hannibal nominated himself. Scipio laughed out loud. "And what if you had defeated me?" he asked. "In that case," Scipio, Hannibal replied, "I would have rated myself first." Scipio, we are told, was quite moved by this compliment, some version of which he had been fishing for all along.